supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Cheney University faces a deadline next week to prove why it should keep its accreditation. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Without accreditation, the nation's oldest historically black university will cease to exist. To help shore up the struggling institution, the Board of Governors overseeing Cheney and the other 13 schools in the Pennsylvania state system of higher education has forgiven more than $30 million in loans. For WHYY, Sarah Hoover reports.
Cheney must cut $7.5 million from this year's budget to have the loans erased and also maintain a balanced budget the following 3 years. The institution has already made 2 rounds of administration and staff cuts. Professor Ivan Turnipseed, chair of the Hospitality and Recreation Management Department, says the loan forgiveness is a game changer, but is concerned about more cuts.
We have to cut all that can be cut, but again, we have to have enough infrastructure and enough heart to stay in our institution for the future.
The school will also consider placing some academic programs into moratorium, meaning they won't accept any new students, and got an exemption to have existing students complete their discontinued program at another state college. Junior Megan Sowersby from Delaware County says students who have to switch schools could get derailed.
I've noticed that often what is seen to be viable options on paper is actually really hard to execute on the ground and hard for students who may not be full-time students, maybe part-time students, non-traditional students, commuting students, that kind of thing. That makes it a lot more difficult for them.
The union representing faculty at Cheney worries that the cuts will scare away prospective students and lead to more financial troubles. Cheney must submit a report to the accrediting body, Middle States Commission on Higher Education, by September 1st, and then an on-site evaluation will follow. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
Some South Jersey residents are suing a major paint company. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains, they claim that years of contamination have caused a cancer cluster in Camden County.
From 1930 to 1978, the paint company Sherwin-Williams operated 3 manufacturing facilities in Gibbsboro. That's a 2-square-mile town of about 2,000 people, just a short drive from Philly. Among the plaintiffs are 2 young girls who've been diagnosed with cancer and a woman who exercised near the plants and claims the contamination caused her kidney disease. Attorney Craig Mitnick, who filed the lawsuit, suspects there are even more alleged victims.
Each time I speak to someone, it's mind-boggling because I hear someone else has cancer or someone else's child has cancer.
A spokesman for Sherwin-Williams says the company just received the lawsuit and declined to comment. Before Sherwin-Williams bought the 3 facilities in Gibbsboro, they had been operated by another paint company since the mid-1850s. The lawsuit chronicles a laundry list of contamination at the sites in recent decades. On several occasions, state regulators found elevated levels of certain cancer-causing substances like lead and arsenic in groundwater and sediment. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency deemed all 3 locations Superfund sites and is working with Sherwin-Williams on plans to clean them up. But attorney Craig Mitnick says the damage is already done.
A Fortune 500 company should have done what they should have done way back when, once they found out about this contamination.
Mitnick says there has been no scientific study to show a link between the contamination and the illnesses suffered by Gibbsboro residents, but he vows to hire investigators to do so in the coming months. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Wilmington, Delaware's east side is an example of a food desert, an urban area where it's difficult to purchase affordable fresh foods. Now there's an effort underway to grow more local food in the heart of the neighborhood, as WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
The Port of Wilmington imports the most fresh fruit of any harbor in North America, but not much, if any, of that fruit gets delivered to Wilmington's east side, which is just 2 miles away. Urban Acres Produce was created to make fruits and vegetables more accessible to those living in the east side.
You are in the Urban Acres Garden, and our garden started out as having nothing here. 2 houses were demolished, and what you see now is the finishing touch of a beautiful garden come together for Eastside residents.
Alfie Moss tends to plants at the community-owned garden.
This is kale, cabbage, this is broccoli. We have onions, and we also have growing here our okra.
The garden is part of the Community Development Corporation at Central Baptist Church. Reverend Terrence Keeling leads the organization.
We started Urban Acres really for two purposes. One, because this was a what they call a food desert. There was no real way of people obtaining nourishing food.
Often it's poor, elderly, young, and sick people who can't access healthy foods, so Urban Acres brings it to them. They run several stands outside senior centers and health clinics.
You guys like oranges? Here.
What do you say?
Let you have one, okay?
Mike Miner is the director of Urban Acres Produce.
The plan was always to have 10 beds for the community, and then the rest of the beds would be for our Urban Acres production, where we could actually grow fresh produce. And really not with the idea of selling it on our stand so much, but what we really wanted to do was to grow produce for some restaurant in town so that the restaurant could say, we're buying local on Church Street. People, you know, think Church Street? You know, how can you buy local from Church Street?
While there are no restaurants buying from the garden yet, it has been a success with those in the community like Alfie Moss.
Before I moved here, I moved from Greenville, Delaware. My husband and I decided that why are we sitting here in the lap of luxury when we need to be somewhere in the community helping?
And it's not just residents pitching in. Mike Miner doesn't live in the area, but he's invested in the community that surrounds the church where he worships. The 73-year-old says his idea of retirement was interrupted.
This was not something in a plan. This is not some vision. This is not. And I tell people even now when people come and they tell me how beautiful this garden is, and I only have to be honest and say, I wish that I could have had a vision that this what this could look like. I had no clue.
Reverend Keeling was confident that change was possible.
Part of what we had to do was make people believe that, hey, that this time something really is going to happen. We didn't allow them to ask us, well, what are you going to do about so-and-so? It's, no, it's not me. It's what are we going to do?
And that call has been met with a response. There are 26 beds in the garden, 13 owned by residents, the rest used for production to sell at the stands. Always forward-thinking, Miner has an even greater goal for Urban Acres Produce.
We want to be the distribution hub for this area. And we're right here by the port, so even in the winter, as the produce comes in from South America and around, and it goes right through Wilmington to Philadelphia Produce Market, we'd like to have some of that stop here in Wilmington. That we could be a full-fledged produce hub in Wilmington, create jobs, create enthusiasm, create welfare, just do a lot of things for our city.
Once the growing season is over in Wilmington this fall, Urban Acres will buy fresh fruits and vegetables at cost from the Philadelphia Produce Market and sell it at their stands through the winter. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
A group of New Jersey teens has been hanging out this summer, going to museums, making s'mores, playing soccer. Half of them are suburban American-born kids. The other half, newly resettled refugees from Iraq and Syria. WHYY's Matt Katz spent some time with them last weekend.
It was Saturday in suburbia, and a group of Syrian, Iraqi, and American teens were at the local library when they decided to go to the field out back to play a little soccer. A Syrian boy asked an American girl if she wanted to be on his team. She said yes.
All right. Okay, let's go. Team.
And that's how it went. The Americans from the Maplewood and South Orange suburbs of North Jersey, and the Syrians and Iraqis, recently resettled as refugees in the area around urban Elizabeth, New Jersey, joined together by a new group called Village to Village United. The organizers thought that if they could bring together a group of kids from different backgrounds, well, something like this could happen.
The happiest moment in my life is when I came to the United States of America, because at this moment I know my future will change because the USA is a country of opportunities.
That's 16-year-old Abdul Ammar from Kurdistan, Iraq, reading an essay he penned as part of a writing exercise with his American peers. He said he was shocked how kind the American kids have been.
When I came here, they were telling me the American people don't like people who don't speak their language or something like that. So that I was, when I came here, I shocked because I saw people communicate and make a friendship.
The organizers of Village to Village United are mostly teachers from the Maplewood area. They raised money for this program at small fundraisers in their homes. That funded a bus to pick up the refugee teens at a mosque in Elizabeth and bring them to meet up with the Maplewood teens to do various bonding exercises, like going on a hike and making s'mores. Another day, they listened to jazz together at the Newark Museum.
When we saw the jazz, remember that? Abdul, you were there, right?
Yeah.
Mohammed.
Jasper Kransdorf also remembered helping Mohammed with an art project. They had to look each other in the eye and draw portraits.
I think about like laughter because I remember I was trying to draw Mohammed's face and I had like this plastic thing up against him. And then when I actually put it down, it like looked nothing like him. So like that was funny to me.
For the last session on Saturday, the teens wrote about this experience, reminiscing about how they had spent the summer. 17-year-old Chana Lauder is from South Orange. She decided to participate because she came to this country from Cambodia as a child, unable to speak English. I talked to her during a break in Saturday's soccer game.
We've all lived on this earth long enough to realize when someone's struggling and needs help, you like support them in any way possible.
For 16-year-old Sofia Ratkovich of Maplewood, support meant simply coming to these events and making friends.
With what's been happening, I just felt like I had to be a part of it and contribute in some way, and I couldn't just sit around. Since it's so close by, I live down the street, this was my way of contributing.
Her new friend, Radi Al-Radi, is from Syria. He's 14, but 15 soon, he told me.
I like it because I will like know a new friend and I will learn more.
Are you guys like friends on Facebook or?
The first time he asked for my number, it was really funny. But yeah, everybody's becoming friends and it's really nice.
After the soccer game, the kids returned to the library for an art show where they displayed the projects they made over the summer to the community. There was a guitar there and three of the Syrians threw an impromptu concert for their new American village.
WHYY's Matt Katz. An overwhelming percentage of Americans want to age at home, but that desire is bumping up against growing pressures and problems in the home care industry. That tension is explored in CARE, a new documentary debuting on WHYY-TV September 7th. Tomorrow night, attendees at our civic space will take in a preview screening with Voices in the Family's Dan Gottlieb and the producer of the film, Tony Hariza, who joins me now. Tony, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
I'm excited to be here.
CARE has at least two meanings. It speaks to that industry and also to CARE, a call to action.
It's an imperative, too.
What is the imperative based on?
Well, I think what we're looking at, and it's inspired somewhat by one of our consultants, Ai-Jen Poo, who's in the film, is she says the question that we're faced right now is how are we going to take care of each other? And as the population ages, particularly the elderly population, is going to grow significantly. And we have some time to think about it. But as you mentioned, the workforce is not prepared. Our economic supports are not prepared.
Ai-Jen Poo is the author of a book entitled Age of Dignity. And we see the humanity in this film. There are a few case studies, as it were, examples of care and the recipient of that care. And the humanity is so evident. But yet, the industry is fraught with so many problems.
It's relatively disorganized. Parts of it are organized. Much of it is what they call gray market, which means you hire anybody you meet on the street to take care of a loved one. It's a lot word of mouth, but those conditions mean that things like pay, working conditions, training are all pretty haphazard. And it means that the work itself doesn't attract the kinds of numbers that we need because it's not one of the jobs that pays well, has benefits, has a track toward growth.
Not only does it not pay well, we learn that the pay is often sub-minimum wage.
In fact, until about a year and a half ago, it was excluded from all workplace protections, minimum wage, overtime, workplace health and safety. The Obama administration brought it under the umbrella of the Fair Labor Standards Act, but it's still, minimum wage is not enough. We want a living wage, at least for our care workers. You see in the film, one of the care workers continues working full-time and more than 40 hours and lives in a shelter because she can't pay for housing in New York City.
Empathy drives the intent of families who want to honor the wish of the elder loved one who wants to stay in his or her home. often to the point, though, where those families risk losing their home to bankruptcy.
It's a huge issue. I mean, I think before Obamacare, they said that the biggest source of bankruptcies was health care costs, right? And I'm wondering if, as we move into this period where more and more of this care is provided, if long-term care may be a similar thing. It erodes people's savings rapidly.
Cause for optimism?
Well, I think one of the things that makes me optimistic is how responsive people are to this issue. It's not being talked about enough, but when we show the film, it resonates deeply with people, partly because they may have had their own experience with grandparents, partly because people are starting to think about baby boomers thinking about their own futures. So I think there's a kind of a fertile seed ground to start this conversation, and that's what we want the film to do.
And of course, that conversation will be continued tomorrow evening at our civic space during this preview screening. You already had one in Portland. Were you surprised by any of the questions or comments?
I think what I was most moved by was the dialogue between the audience and the people who provided care. It's a hidden profession, and this was an opportunity to ask these care workers how it felt, how they dealt with issues. The audience was really, really moved by these professionals who are seriously underpaid professionals.
The documentary certainly peels back the curtain on this hidden profession. In fact, most of it, to my viewing, was almost claustrophobically close. We're in hallways and bedrooms and kitchens and very close up of the face-to-face encounters between the giver and the recipient. And it really draws you in. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for having me.
Tony Hariza will be at WHYY's Civic Space tomorrow evening for the documentary's preview screening, along with Voices in the Family's Dr. Dan Gottlieb. CARE debuts on WHYY TV September 7th. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The city of Philadelphia has redesigned the LGBTQ pride flag, adding black and brown to its rainbow of stripes. The move comes after calls for inclusion in the Gayborhood, the nickname for a portion of Center City where there are lots of lesbian and gay-friendly bars and businesses. The new flag debuted this summer, but when you walk around the Gayborhood, you mostly see the 1979 version of the flag. Next Generation radio reporter Taylor Allen walked through the heart of the neighborhood with Abdul Ali Muhammad, an outspoken advocate for people of color. Muhammad helped raise the redesigned flag at a city hall ceremony in June.
I never saw myself in the rainbow, but I never carried around a rainbow flag because I saw it as a white symbol. My name is Abdul Ali Muhammad, and I'm a community organizer. I'm a positive activist, openly HIV positive. I'm queer, I'm non-binary, and yeah, that's who I am.
Abdul Muhammad, the shining Aquila. From the Black and Brown Workers Club.
That day it was probably like over 100 people at the flag raising ceremony. Mayor Kinney was there. Amber Hikes, who's the new director of the Office of LGBT Affairs, was there.
So let's continue the fight for justice as we launch this beautiful new symbol of diversity.
So it was a bunch of community members present.
All right. I think we are ready to go ahead and raise that flag.
I saw how people found joy and representation in the symbol. I love it. I love the fact that black and brown stripe is disrupting the rainbow. I think that is, it kind of captures where we're at in the context of this conversation around safer spaces, right? Or supposed safer spaces for LGBTQ people. And we know from the history of Philadelphia over the past two and a half years that black and brown community members had challenges, struggle, and had a lot of anti-blackness to confront in the context of the Gayborhood. I have had many experiences with racism in the Gayborhood in Philly. I had a hoodie on, and I was coming from work, and I was hanging out with some friends in the bar, and some plainclothes gentleman came up to me and asked me for ID after I had entered the bar. And I said, "Why are you asking me for ID? Who are you?" And they wouldn't tell me who they were. And then after the third time of me asking, they said they were undercover police and that I fit the description of someone. I went to the bouncer and I said, you know, this wouldn't have happened to me if I were a white patron. You know me. I work in a nonprofit right around the corner. I come in here frequently. And so when the undercovers came in, you could have said something and you didn't. As someone who's Muslim and queer, I don't find sanctuary. I don't find places I can make salat in terms of people who are Muslim and queer. We don't have spaces of worship. We can't go to a mosque in Germantown or a mosque in West Philadelphia. They're just not safe spaces for us. I think the flag is a symbolic gesture that will allow community to point to that flag and say, you said yourself that you're committed to listening to centering black and brown community members, and we're going to hold you accountable, right? People were crossing out the black and brown stripe. I think people are against the flag because of their internalized racism. If you're mad at black and brown community members finding joy or developing a symbol that reflects them, then that means that you don't see the humanity in them, and you actually don't see them as a part of your community.
Abdul Ali Muhammad talking about Philadelphia's redesigned LGBTQ flag. The story was produced for Next Generation Radio by Taylor Allen. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.